This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The practice of shark finning is banned in Florida and may soon be throughout the U.S., but a just published study by a shark researcher at Sarasota's Moat Marine Laboratory says that a U.S. ban would have little to no effect on the sharks. We'll hear why his research led to that determination later in the show. But first, the Everglades python problem is not news to most Southwest Floridians, but what may be news is the unforeseen effects that the snake's voracious appetite is having on the spread of disease, and not just disease among animals, disease that can be passed to humans. A pet that was fashionable in the 80s, pythons, were brought to Florida from the other side of the globe. But some of these pet owners decided to set their pythons free, and those former pets found an all-you-can-eat buffet of fauna in the Everglades, where they love the living conditions, and proliferated throughout the swamp. Current estimates guess that these pests have multiplied to 30,000 to 300,000 invasive snakes. Researchers have found that they've decimated the Everglades fauna to the point that there is little left but the exponentially procreative cotton rat. And this is where the mosquitoes come in and where the research of our guest links the python's appetite to the rise of the Everglades virus. Dr. Nathan Burkett Cadena works at University of Florida's Florida Medical Entomology Laboratory. He joins us by phone. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Julie. How are you doing?
It's great to have you. This is a really interesting topic. We're talking about the link between invasive snakes and a mosquito-spread virus that we haven't seen much of until now, the Everglades virus. You can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Nathan Burkett Cardena, your study is in the area of entomology. So how did your research lead you to the invasive python?
Well, it was a fairly circuitous route. So we were investigating the ecology of a particular mosquito in the Everglades. This mosquito is called Culex cdci, and that is a direct derivative of CDC in honor of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So a student of mine, Isaiah Hoyer, who's the first author on the publication that came out of this, was going down to the Everglades to collect this mosquito and figuring out what they're feeding on. So that's really important for viruses like Everglades virus, which are in a group of viruses or pathogens that are called zoonotic pathogens. And this is really important for understanding the context of the story. So these zoonotic pathogens are actually germs that infect wild animals. So West Nile virus is a famous example of these zoonotic pathogens. Lyme disease is another example of a zoonotic pathogen. So the insects or the arachnids that transmit these pathogens aren't born with it. They don't acquire it from the soil or the water. They have to get this germ from a wild animal that they bite. So in the case of Lyme disease, it's particular rodents. In the case of West Nile virus, it's wild birds. So understanding which animals these vector species, so these ticks and mosquitoes are biting, is really important for us trying to understand the transmission cycles of these pathogens. So my student was going down to the Everglades to capture this Culex cdci, bring it back into the laboratory, and use the DNA of the animal's blood that's in the gut of that mosquito to figure out what they were feeding on. So one sample after another was coming back with the result of being the hispid cotton rat. So this cotton rat is one of the only known hosts for Everglades virus in nature. And so we were trying to make sense of this. We were comparing what we were seeing today with studies that were done in the 1970s using a similar technology, where they found that this mosquito was actually feeding on deer. It was feeding on rabbits. It was feeding on raccoons. It was also feeding on the rat, but it was feeding on a much greater diversity of animals.
So that so this is research that was done in kind of like, what, the 70s and 80s? And you found that back then this same mosquito had blood in its gut of a lot of different animals. But then today you're seeing just that cotton rat.
That's exactly right. So as we tried to understand our results, it hit us that, wow, these animals just aren't available anymore. Some very important studies done within the past 10 years or so have shown this precipitous, severe decline in the abundance of deer, of rabbits, of raccoons in the Everglades, and they attributed that decline to the rise in the spread of the Burmese python. And so what we were able to put together from our results and the results of these other studies was that this python has established itself in the Everglades. It has basically eaten all of these medium and large-sized mammals, so that really the only mammal left for this vector mosquito to bite is this cotton rat, which is a source of the virus for the mosquitoes.
Which just so happens to be the one that can carry the Everglades virus. So, like, for example, if the python had missed all the bunnies and ate all the rats, we would not be looking at this Everglades virus situation.
That's exactly right.
Do they just not like these kinds of rats?
No, they do like these kinds of rats. In fact, some studies that have been done, some of my colleagues at the University of Florida, Dr. Romagosa, who has captured these snakes, killed the snakes, opened their guts, have found lots and lots of these cotton rats or parts of these cotton rats inside the stomach of these Burmese python. The explanation that scientists have come to of why these cotton rats have persisted when the rabbits and the deer and the raccoons are not is the explosive breeding potential of these rodents and the number that of rodents that the habitat can sustain. So if you look at, say, an acre of land, it's supposed to be able to support 2 to 3 rabbits, less than 1 deer, of course. But that same acre of land can support the growth and reproduction of dozens of rats. So by just there being so many of them and they're breeding so many times per year with lots of litter, they're able to overcome the effects of the python predation.
I wonder if there's ever going to be a time when the pythons have just eaten so much of everything that they actually starve. I mean, I think one took out an alligator once, too. So, I mean, I guess they'll find whatever they can.
And that's another important reason why these rabbit, raccoon, and deer populations can't rebound. Because when a python doesn't have anything to eat, it just goes into a state of dormancy. So it can wait until more rabbits and raccoons and deer enter the area. Whereas a warm-blooded animal, a warm-blooded predator like a Florida panther, like a bobcat, they can't do that. So they have this high resting metabolism, which requires them to have to eat a certain number of prey items every day. So they have this physiological drive to be active hunters on a daily basis. If they don't, they'll starve to death very rapidly. That doesn't happen for the Burmese python. The Burmese python can't find food for a month. All it does is go into a state of dormancy. When more prey are available, it'll start to become active again and eat those animals. So in that way, the prey populations can't even rebound from a loss of predator.
So is this rat the only animal that can carry the Everglades fever?
There are, as far as we know in Florida, there are only two animals which can carry this Everglades virus. One is the cotton rat, the other one is the cotton mouse. And both of these are doing quite well in the Everglades National Park still.
Cottonmouth snake?
No, cottonmouth.
Mouse.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Another rodent.
I thought you said cottonmouth snake. I was like, oh, not more snakes.
That's so, all we need is a venomous viper being the reservoir for human pathogens.
No, that would not be my favorite. This is really frightening. I mean, you know, this sets off a lot of alarm bells because we all remember rats as vectors or carriers of lots of diseases. I mean, they're credited for the spread of the bubonic plague that killed, like, what, half of Europe in the Middle Ages. What's different about the Everglades virus that these cats carry? I mean, these rats carry?
So Everglades virus is really just endemic to Florida. So, I mean, as far as what makes it different from bubonic plague, plague is a bacterium. It can be transmitted from person to person once it goes to the bubonic stage, and that is not known to occur in Everglades virus. You only get infected with Everglades virus if you're bitten by a mosquito that has picked that virus up from an infected rodent. So the transmission cycles are quite a bit different.
So the Culex CDCI, the one that was named after the Centers for Disease Control, which is kind of a funny irony, did they do that on purpose?
Yes, they did.
It was in
honor of studies that were done in the Everglades in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
But do these mosquitoes only stay in the Everglades? Are they going to, you know, keep that Everglades fever there with themselves and the rats?
So that's a great question. So this mosquito species is only found in southern Florida, and it is mostly restricted to fairly wild habitats, so the swamps, the mangroves, the cypress marshes of the Everglades ecosystem, the greater Everglades ecosystem. It does not do well in developed areas where there are houses or buildings or streets. This mosquito really doesn't do well in developed places. However, there is another mosquito which is just newly introduced to North America. This is Culex panocossa. And this mosquito transmits related viruses very well in the American tropics. And this new mosquito, Culex panocossa, does do well in developed areas. So we may have a situation where although Culex CDCI isn't going to be important in biting human beings because of its sort of wild, remote areas that it persists in, this new mosquito is linking those wild habitats to more developed areas where you are do have lots of human beings, and the risk of Everglades virus transmission could increase because of that.
Okay, I want to break that down. So you're one of the people that helped uncover the fact that the Culex panocossa was here. Was about a year ago?
That's right.
So you found this guy all of a sudden coming up here from the tropics, and he is A-okay with hanging around where people are. So where is the Culex panocossa going to get the Everglades virus? Will it happen upon it from one of these cotton rats? Do the cotton rats go into cities?
Cotton rats will do well in residential areas, but they're not going to do well in cities per se. So what we don't know, for example, since Culex CDCI does very poorly in cities, we don't know if the rats that live in cities could be a good host for the virus, because those rats have never been exposed because they've never come in contact with Culex CDCI. So to answer your question, we don't have an answer for that question. We really don't know where Culex panocossa populations are going to come in contact with cotton rats and where that distribution would overlap with the range of Culex CDCI. These are things that we really want to work out in the coming years.
Yes. Well, things are kind of one hit after the other, though. I mean, you just found this one Culex panocossa here, and then, you know, now you have this information about the fact that the CDCI is only feeding on these cotton rats, which are the thing that carries this Everglades virus. It's really kind of frightening when you think about it.
That's Florida for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a lesser Australia. We're talking about a new study showing python's impact on the spread of Everglades fever, and you can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So, with this Culex panocossa, we're often told to remove any standing water that we can, like flower pots that fill up around the house after rain, to avoid helping the Aedes aegypti, which we all know and love from their spreading of Zika virus. Is this something that people should also do in order to avoid giving a breeding ground to a mosquito like the Culex panocossa or even the CDCI if he happens to wander into your neighborhood?
That's an excellent question, Julian. Brings me to a topic which I love to talk about, is mosquito diversity. So there are more than 3,600 described species of mosquito in the world. So that's a lot. Mosquitoes are incredibly diverse. So in Florida, we have about 80 different species of mosquito. Some of those mosquitoes, like Aedes aegypti, as you mentioned, proliferate, and they lay their eggs, and their larvae develop in buckets of water, dirty bird baths, discarded automobile tires. So we call these container type habitats. And if you care about the mosquitoes that transmit dengue and chikungunya, Zika virus and yellow fever virus, all of those mosquitoes really proliferate in this peri-urban environment and residential environment. Totally not the case for Culex panocossa or Culex CDCI. So Culex CDCI, which we've mentioned, is really restricted to these swamp type habitats, fairly distant from where humans are living and working. Culex panocossa is intimately associated with canals of water, which particularly hold one species of aquatic plant, which is called water lettuce. So water lettuce is considered an invasive and noxious aquatic weed, fills up our canals and waterways and lakes and ponds throughout the state. So this mosquito lays its eggs on the leaves of that particular plant. When the leaf sort of senesces and enters the water, the eggs will hatch and the larvae develop in association with these roots of water lettuce.
So we have
any canal, ditch, pond that supports water lettuce will likely in the future support populations of Culex panocossa.
So we have an invasive mosquito living on an invasive plant in canals, which we've made.
Isn't it poetic?
Yeah, well, canals, which we have made, which is also excellent. Okay, so we have a call coming in from Matt in Everglades. Matt, what would you like to ask?
Hi, yes. So I kind of found that ironic that I'm actually in the middle of the Sakehatchee Strand when I'm listening to this. So my question is, I'm actually from Central Florida. I'm not from down here. Is there a way I can tell the difference between, say, a regular mosquito and this other species that carries this virus?
That's a good question. Do you ever get close enough to actually see them? I never see them. They kind of get me and fly away. Are you talking about ones that you might see maybe in a pond or in a puddle?
I guess if I saw a mosquito and I know that I've been bitten by this mosquito, is there a way to tell the difference between, say, a mosquito I've encountered and this mosquito that is carrying this Everglades virus? And two, does the same repellents that work on those other types of mosquitoes work on this species?
That is an excellent question, Matt. I'm going to have him give that to you off the phone and listen to it on the air. So those are two really excellent questions. Can you tell the difference between the different kinds of mosquitoes, and do they all respond to the same kind of mosquito repellent?
So those are two very excellent questions, Matt. Thank you for that. So unfortunately, there is no easy, naked eye way to look at a mosquito that's biting you on the arm and know whether it's an important mosquito or not. So the Aedes mosquitoes that transmit dengue, Zika, chikungunya have striped legs. These are black mosquitoes with white stripes on their legs and a bold stripe pattern on their thorax. So that just means that that species is capable of carrying those specific viruses. Doesn't mean that the one that's on your arm is going to be infecting you with that virus. In fact, the likelihood of that happening is about the same as winning the lottery. It's just a lottery that you don't want to win. The Culex mosquitoes are some of the most difficult mosquitoes to identify in the entire world. There are just very few characteristics from telling one Culex from another. So these are usually small brown mosquitoes. They don't have bands or stripes for the most part, and so just very challenging to look at any mosquito and know whether you should be concerned or not. I can say this. The smaller mosquitoes, the tiny mosquitoes, are often the ones that are associated with virus transmission. The very large mosquitoes, the galley nippers that are biting you after a very heavy rain, sort of those that would follow Irma or Maria or Nate, those mosquitoes are generally not important in the transmission of human pathogens. So size can be helpful. Your other question about repellents.
Yeah.
Repellents should work across the board with mosquitoes. So if you're talking about a repellent with beet in it, so that is not actually a repellent. What it is a topical anesthetic. So mosquitoes need to be able to find an individual capillary under your skin with their sensors before they actually pierce your skin. So if you anesthetize those sensors with a substance like beet, it makes it impossible for that mosquito to find those capillaries under your skin to locate them. And so the mosquito will decide basically that you're not an animal with blood after all, and it'll simply fly away. So by desensitizing those sensors on the biting apparatus and the feet of the mosquito, what you do is prevent it from being able to find that blood vessel.
So what's happened with this research, and let me ask another question real quick about repellent. Do these mosquitoes all respond the same when it comes to municipal attempts to get rid of mosquitoes as far as, you know, spraying and aerial spraying? I know that there's different kinds with sterilization efforts and then also just trying to kill them after they've been hatched. Do they all respond kind of the same?
They do not respond all the same. So depending on how much the species or the population is exposed to a specific pesticide, they can develop genetic resistance to those insecticides. And so even in the same population, say a particular city, some species will become resistant to the insecticide that's being used, while other species will not. And this has to do with lots of different things related to each individual mosquito species biology, its rate of reproduction, how much it's exposed to the specific pesticide. So mosquito-controlled districts in Florida, for the most part, are very aware of these problems with insecticide resistance, and so they rotate the chemicals they use so that if a mosquito species or population starts to become resistant to a particular insecticide, they can eliminate that resistance gene by using another insecticide that will kill those individuals developing the resistance.
All right.
So they react differently, but it's managed.
Yeah, well, we are just about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking the time to explain all of this. It's a circuitous, as you mentioned before, study, but very, very interesting. Thank you, Dr. Nathan Burkett Cardena of University of Florida's Medical Entomology. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Julie. It was my pleasure.
Coming up, the brutal practice of shark finning. When a live shark is pulled from the water, its dorsal fin is cut off by a human and the animal is thrown back in the water, oftentimes alive but unable to swim, is banned in Florida and may soon be in the entire U.S. But one researcher warns that it won't do much good. We'll find out why next. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.